podcast on this May Day weekend. This is the weekend on which we remember those who came before us and fought for rights we enjoy today. Rights that are under attack from the right, who want us to be living precarious, struggling lives so they can profit from our worries on not being able to pay their bills, bills from their power corporations, their banks, and their food and their water cash cows. Today I remember the strike my grandfather told me about in early 1920s Ulster when he was a young worker, when during the Irish independence struggle, a factory owner urged the Protestant workers to drum the Catholics out of the factory. The union had dared to ask for a pay rise. The UKIP-style hate-mongering of the upper classes and the divide-and-conquer tactics that held one part of the community above the other, the kind of bigotry we see in America where the divide-and-conquer tactic is all too visible in the racism and the with the residents of Baltimore and Detroit and other communities across the once openly racially segregated state, now resulting in open rebellion, was a tactic first tried out in the Irish colony, and during the Irish upheavals of the 1920s, the Ulster Linen Lords played on it. My grandfather described the local Orange Lodge marching to the factory and literally drumming the Catholics out, and in doing so, broke their own union, and the local Linen Lord lowered the pay throughout the factory. My grandfather, who was from a Protestant Unionist background, passed down the knowledge he gleaned from this. The divide and conquer tactics were not designed to give privilege to anyone but those with power and money already, and to keep all of us powerless, broken and broke. In today's podcast, Michael Greenwell continues his interview series. Last week he interviewed Neil Davidson on his views on the EU. This week he interviews SSP co-spokesperson Colin Fox on his. I was out campaigning in Glasgow East for our candidate there, Liam McLaughlin, and spoke to the candidate himself and Richie Venton and Steve Hudson, who have, with the help of many others, have been manning the stalls and leafleting throughout the constituency. Deborah Torrens, Socialist SNP member from Mulgay, tells us about her sadness at the departing of the Scottish Labour Party. Dave Riley, a member of the Australian Socialist Alliance, reports from the outback and explains the origins of the Australian racist immigration policies that UKIP would like to see us adopt. Don McKean speaks on the decline of the American industrial dream and what is happening in Baltimore, Ferguson and Detroit. Former Labour for Independence member and now SSP member Alan Grogan on why the left should unite behind the electoral revolution of the SSP. And SSP candidate and co-spokesperson Sandra Webster on her campaign in the former Scottish Labour mini-state and what is now seen in these extraordinary times as a marginal seat, Paisley and Renfrewshire South. Over the past few weeks, I hope I've been able to introduce to you music that isn't Mumford & Sons. Today is no exception. Usually I start with some banging track, but the wonderful Suzanne Jewell sent me the next track, Hands in My Pocket, a collaboration with London-based artist Swift Beats. It's my new favourite track. I'll list all of the other tracks included on the podcast on sspcampsy.podbean.com.
Why do I dream? Like Glasgow, Baltimore had about 1 million residents in the 1950s, and now has around 600,000. And also like Glasgow, where it once had well-paying jobs, it now has endemic poverty. Baltimore has been hit by neoliberalism. Starting in the 1950s, Baltimore's harbor was revitalized, quote-unquote, one of the first projects of its kind, turning what had been a working harbor into a privatized shopping space. It's been hailed as a great success. It won an architecture award in the 1980s, but that hasn't stopped the city's decline, loss of jobs, and population. And now another black man has been killed by police. 25-year-old Freddie Gray made the unfortunate mistake of making eye contact with police. They then chased him, arrested him, and then he ended up dying with spinal injuries. And as with Ferguson, there's been a furious reaction from the residents with scenes that are reminiscent of the 1960s. And like the 1960s, we have poverty and war. After World War II, working-class Americans enjoyed a couple of decades of decent jobs, decent housing, and a feeling that there really was an American dream. The Detroit activist Malik Yakini said that in Detroit, auto workers were making more than college graduates. But the great visionaries who ran the auto industry in Detroit were sure that Americans would never buy fuel-efficient cars, and along with economic stagflation and the oil crisis, the American car industry collapsed and the German and Japanese car industry grew. Detroit once made most of the cars on Earth. Now its official unemployment rate is 30%, the city is bankrupt and run by an unelected emergency manager. The city is turning off the water of people who can't pay their bills, something the UN has declared as a practice that violates human rights. The economic situation in Baltimore is no better. Baltimore's unemployment rate is 8%, and in the U.S. as a whole it's 6%. But in Freddie Gray's neighborhood of Sandtown, the unemployment rate is 50%. 33% of the homes there are vacant. Despite the promises that America's leaders have made that if you work hard and behave responsibly, you will succeed, the reality of American capitalism has always been that you are on your own. Cities like Baltimore and Detroit were what made America a rich and powerful country. But they outlived their usefulness. In the 1960s, there was a threat to the powerful from organized citizens. People saw incomes rise, legislation passed to protect the environment and health and safety at work. The solution to this, the neoliberal solution, was first rolled out in the USA in 1970s New York. Jerry Ford, Secretary of the Treasury, said, "Tell the city to drop dead. I want New York to hurt so bad that no other city would try to do what New York did." The municipal services that worked for the people in education, healthcare, and public transport were cut, and New York City began its slide into gentrification. By the 1980s, Reagan had applied this logic to the whole country. The geographer David Harvey points out that in the 1960s, the 400 richest people in America were worth $650 million on average. Now they're worth around $2 trillion. Freddie Gray was the 348th person killed by the U.S. police since the start of the year. On Monday, 20-year-old Terrence Cullum of Detroit was shot 10 times by police who were serving him a warrant. His family say he was unarmed. This story of rampant state violence and poverty is as American as apple pie. It's how and why the system works. The Detroit activist and philosopher Grace Lee Boggs and her late husband Jimmy identified that the Detroit riots of the 60s were rebellions. She said, "We were fortunate to have the urban rebellions of the 60s, which forced us to make a distinction between rebellion and revolution. People called them riots, but we knew that they went beyond just riots. And so we started to look at the difference and to recognize the nature of revolution. We had to understand what had gone on before, in our history, and what was now different. That's as true for us in Scotland as it is in the USA." In Baltimore, the Washington Post reports that Sarah Chestnut brought her nephew from Detroit because she thought it would be better for him. He was shot in the back 8 times near to where Freddie Gray was shot. And she feels that Detroit is now better than Baltimore. She says, "In Baltimore, all we have are liquor stores and funeral homes."
SSP have been out in force in the constituencies we're fielding candidates. I interrupted Richie Venton and Stevie Hudson while they were out campaigning in Easterhouse for our candidate in Glasgow East, Liam McLaughlin, and I asked them about how the campaign was going and their thoughts on the election. I then phoned Liam for his take on the campaign. Please excuse the phone noises in his piece.
The Scottish Socialist Party have made an impact on the streets, on the issues. because we've come to the heart of the matter, the fact that there's rampant poverty in a very rich country, the fact that people are suffering the rampant insecurity of zero contracts and poverty pay. And our campaign for secure jobs and £10 an hour minimum wage has definitely hit home with an awful lot of people. In terms of whether that means they'll vote for the Scottish Socialist Party is a different matter, because unfortunately right now there's this tidal wave, in fact a tsunami, in the direction of the SNP, which is partly revenge for what Labour has done for decades by saying that, you know, we're all middle class and there's no ideology to be fought for and we're all going to just make big business richer and that'll trickle down to us. It's also revenge for them being in bed with the Tories for a couple of years during the referendum. And the SNP have a very easy task, because if you want to sound a bit more left-wing or progressive than Labour, it's hardly a compliment to be so, given how right-wing they've become. So there's a massive movement in the direction of voting for the SNP, even though people accept our criticisms of their shortcomings. They almost want to put their hands over their ears when we point out that the SNP are not consistent even on independence, that they want to remain in NATO under the thumb of the European Central Bank or the Bank of England, etc. And they still vote for them in the same fashion, frankly, as people in 97 voted Labour to get the Tories out. Now people are voting SNP to get Labour out. And it's very negative. I don't think it's a particularly principled approach, where you should vote for what you believe in and not against what you're against. But time will tell and show that there's severe shortcomings in the SNP compared to what we argue for. We're also, I'll add that we're the only party that's held public meetings in the whole of the election campaign, leaving aside debates, hustings. And they've been very useful, because new people have come, joined the Scottish Socialist Party, and we're building a force up for the future, for when people begin to question in practice what the SNP do in practice, as opposed to just being an anti-Labour vote.
Okay. And Steve, you were saying earlier on about 1997, about Scotland getting rid of the Tories. Do you think come next Thursday we'll have gotten rid of the Tories if the polls turn out to be true?
You mean the Tories in Scotland?
Yeah.
You mean the Labour Party?
Well, the Labour Party, and do you feel that in the SNP, if they have a full sweep, that's getting rid of the Tories?
I think that in terms of the election campaign, we've campaigned against 0 hours contracts. Everybody supports the campaign, supports our call for a £10 an hour minimum wage now, not in 2020 like the Greens have talked about, like SNP have talked about. The overwhelming feeling is, though, on the stalls, let's fuck Labour. There is no doubt about that. And I think that, you know, one of the things I'm looking forward to on election night is seeing a lot of Labour careers over, you know what I mean? Like, because we all know once you lose your seat, if you're in the Labour Party, that's you out of politics. So I think it will be, based on what people are saying, an overwhelming victory for the SNP. But at the same time, you know, we can't underestimate overwhelming support for the campaigns that we've been waging. So, yeah, I think that the majority of people are voting to get rid of Labour, who have been in charge in Glasgow, in Scotland for generations, and nothing has changed.
Okay. And Richie, do you feel that that's an answer to the 1997 thing, when we're supposed to have got rid of Tories? Do you think next week the victory that's being predicted for the SNP is doing that? Is getting rid of right-wing politics in Scotland?
Well, first of all, I'd add in a factor that every time the Tories whip up this, what they see as a scaremongering story about the SNP running the show as part of an alliance with the Labour in government, every time they utter that, it reinforces the SNP vote, because there's not only a hatred of Labour, there's an even more deep-seated historic hatred of the Tories in Scotland. So therefore, when the Tories tell you not to vote SNP, it reinforces the SNP vote. So I think it's a weird combination of being a vote against the Tories as well as being a vote against Labour. In terms of his comparison at 97, in 1997, our predecessor, you know, which we were part of, the Scottish Socialist Alliance, stood candidates. We knew we were going to get battered in terms of the votes. But we also knew we had an historic duty to hold up a spotlight on what Labour was like, to warn people, you might be voting Labour now to get the Tories out, but this is what's coming your direction. And by Christ, we're proven right when it comes to the record of Labour in government 13 years thereafter. And in the case of the SNP, I'm not saying it'll be exactly a replica of that or as rapid an exposure of their weaknesses, but I would say that when you've got a party that tries to face two directions at once, in the end they get found out. Because when they talk about the minimum wage, the very fact that they and Labour have talked about the minimum wage, I think, without boasting too much, is in part because of the noise we've created on the subject alongside allies like the Bakers Workers Union, where we fought for £10 now. And there's such a surge of anger about poverty pay that these mainstream politicians have had to recognise that in their propaganda. But the SNP are saying, like Labour, we'll bring in a minimum wage in 2020, but it'll be £8.70, which would be less than today's so-called living wage of 7.85. So when we say £10 now, that in itself concretely shows a difference of approach. They want to win working class votes, and they will, and at the same time not upset big business. And they're clever at facing both ways in that respect. However, I think after a while, when they don't tackle the powers that be in terms of big business, and they try to appease them and bribe them into greater investment through corporation tax cuts in the future and so on, then that'll begin to show that the shortcomings. And already, of course, we know that SNP councils, or SNP Labour coalitions in the case of Edinburgh, have carried out savage cuts to council workers' jobs and services to the public. But for the mass of the population, they might sometimes acknowledge that, but they don't want to hear it. They'd rather not hear it. They'll suspend their criticism of that in order to give Labour a kicking and at the same time avenge the Tory propaganda by voting SNP. So it'll be a clearing of the decks from a treacherous Labour Party, but then the job for socialists is to remain alive and critical and to build up an alternative to an SNP that will be rampant and massive, but at the same time will be trying to face both ways, and you can't do that indefinitely.
And just lastly, how's the campaign been going here in Glasgow East?
The campaign has been very good in terms of getting support for the policies we advocate. The fact that we're for a £10 minimum wage now, for abolition of zero contracts and secure jobs instead with guaranteed hours. The fact that we're for abolition of the anti-union laws, which no other party has even mentioned, let alone promised anything on, including the SNP. And also, there's big support for the unique policy of the Scottish Socialist Party on the wage an MP should take. We think it's scandalous in an age of austerity and poverty pay that MPs are about to have an increase in their wages from £67,000 a year to £74,000 a year. That puts them on a different planet to ordinary people. So there's big support for the idea of an MP, a socialist MP, living on a worker's wage, which is unique to our party and always has been our policy. So there's a lot of support for those things and attends at our public meetings, like I said. But it won't translate into a huge vote, unfortunately, this time round, but preparation for 2016.
Okay, thanks very much, guys.
Hi there, this is Liam McLaughlin here. I'm the Scottish Socialist Party candidate in Glasgow East in the general election. This is just another wee kind of a quick update, because I know I've spoken either the last podcast or the one before that, just on the campaign, so this is just what's been happening. Since we're a week to go, we're looking forward to the last week of campaigning here in Glasgow East. We've got our final public meeting to look forward to next Tuesday in Bairstown. We've had a 40,000 Royal Mail leaflet drop, ensuring that the whole constituency gets a Scottish Socialist Party material leaflet. We've been running regular street stalls, which we've done this morning up at Easter House Shopping Centre. We've got one tomorrow at the Forge, one on Saturday at the Forge as well. So we're really looking forward to the last week to go. We set ourselves four targets at the start of the campaign. We've already hit all four of those, so we're a week to go, really. It's all steam ahead from now on. Let's utilise the party message, take our unique socialist case for an independent socialist Scotland, a modern democratic republic, a £10 an hour living wage for everybody over 16, now, not in 2020, and any other distant date. The hustings events have been going on really well in the constituency. We've had the one in Bairstown, we've had one in Easterhouse last week, and we've got one final one on Sunday night in Cranhill as well. So far the Scottish Socialist Party message has been well received in the constituency. We've raised the profile of the party, we've raised the profile of me as a candidate, and we've managed to hold the rest of the parties to account in the area, and we look forward and hope that we get a respectable voting figure come next Thursday. But regardless of the vote, the Scottish Socialist Party is here to stay. We're here to build in Glasgow East, and we're looking forward to met last week and going forward into next year's Scottish Parliament elections, working with our friends and comrades across Glasgow, who's also been doing fantastic work out in Glasgow South West. So all in all, this general election campaign's been fantastic for the SSP. We've took our new activists who joined in the aftermath of the referendum, we've blended them in right into the party structures, we've got them out campaigning, we've got them used to running an election campaign, and that experience is going to be invaluable next year as we look to cement a strong socialist presence back in Holyrood, because God knows it definitely needs it. So I'm thankful for everybody for supporting the campaign so far. If any of you want to get involved in the last week, you can email me on LiamMCL, that's LiamMCL1996@gmail.com, or you can get in touch through GlasgowEastSSP@gmail.com. Thanks for all your support, and I look forward to seeing the results next Thursday and commenting on the podcast in the future. Bye. We'll be right back.
I was waiting for a bus after a day's campaigning yesterday, and I noticed for the first time a new poster. It said, "This is a marginal constituency. Use your vote well." I thought, this is the first time that this has been the case in my whole life. The Scottish political landscape has always been dominated by the Labour Party as long as I can remember. Douglas Alexander, who I'm standing against in Paisley and Renfrewshire South, increased his majority to 16,000 votes last time. Who would have thought that the SNP, who lost their majority at the last local elections, would be ahead in the polls? We worked with the SNP during the Yes campaign and at conference voted for the Yes Alliance. But riding along on the crest of a wave, they decided to stand alone and state they are the voice of Scotland. Personally, I think that any one party stage is worrying. That's one of the reasons we decided to stand. We are the original anti-austerity party. We care about what happens after independence. As you can imagine, this has been an interesting campaign for us. We've had regular columns in the local press and mainstream media, been invited on radio and TV. Well, a baffled world wonders what on earth is going on. This is the first time I have stood, and I've learned so much, as has the rest of my branch. Things have been different this time. Now, you can't beat the old techniques of talking to people at stalls, having public meetings, but we have also used social media to reach more people. You've managed to avoid the tribalism of the SNP and Labour, and been proud to share the People's Manifesto. I'm proud that I'm a member of a small party with big thinking and an even bigger heart. We've heard so many stories from people in this campaign. One that I will always remember is a woman who's been sanctioned for 2 years. I'm proud that we are calling for an end to sanctions and that we have nudged other parties to the left. Today on May Day, when I send you greetings, I remember especially all those who have gone before me and have stood before me. You've created footfalls that have eased my standing, and I hope to do the same for all my comrades who will stand in the future. I also want to thank the comrades in my branch and in the wider party and friends who have been such a support to me. Only a few days to go and Paisley High Street will be empty. Apart from us, of course. We will be there on the 8th of May and every week after, doing what we always do. Being there for people in our community, creating solidarity and calling those out who should know better to account.
TSG always get their man, just RC and Tomlinson. One bloke walking on his own, one bloke trying to get home. Don't sit on the tube and chill, you know these fuckers shoot and kill. John Charles didn't do nothing wrong. Bang, 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 he's gone. Does a TSG always get their man? State stormtroopers in their own special van. No accountability, just collusion. No responsibility, no prosecution. And I wanna know what kind of cunt stands guard at a meeting at a National Front. And I wanna know who the fucking hell kettles the opponents of the EDL. Cause the TSG always get their man. State stormtroopers in their own special van. No accountability, just collusion. No responsibility, no prosecution. TSG, TSG, might as well be the SPG. Same game, different name, we all know they're the fucking same. Harry Stanley knows what we mean, shot by the crew of an ARV. Cause the TSG always get their man.
state stormtroopers in their own special van. No accountability, just collusion. No responsibility, no prosecution. Get a TSG, always get their man. Just Aussie and Tomlinson. 1,000 brothers and sisters gone dead at the hands of Bobby Long. Blair Peach, David Ewing, to name but two. Cynthia Jarrett and Sean Reed too. You'll never hear an honest report. You'll never see their killers in court. Cause the TSG always get their man. State stormtroopers in their own special van. No accountability, just collusion. No responsibility, no prosecution. No responsibility, no prosecution. No responsibility, no prosecution.
I thought I should get going because there's a storm coming. And, well, I've just received a warning that's going to be a ferocious one. And since we have a tin roof here, any storm is bound to be very noisy for the purposes of audio recording. While you Scots have been caught up in your national perspective, here in Australia it doesn't pan out the same way. Over the last week has been celebrations to mark the 100th anniversary of the landing of Gallipoli of Australian troops during the early period of the First World War. And this event, in which over 8,000 soldiers, Australian soldiers died, has been turned into a sort of less we forget argument generated to celebrate the whole concept of the Australian ethos, which supposedly is all about standing up for yourself, being independent and working for the empire, as was the case during the First World War. The First World War in Australia came soon after the major colonies federated. Federation was in 1901, and when the war came along, it was deployed as a major assertion of Australian independence. Not really, but that's how it gets panned out. An assertion of an outlook where Anglo-Celts on the other side of the world could also sign up and serve for the empire, but do it on their own terms. So in the process of the war, the years of war, almost 500,000 Australians and a population of 4.9 million at the time enlisted to serve the empire as cannon fodder in the initial example in invading Turkey, the Ottoman Empire at Gallipoli, but also in the trenches of France, where I lost my grandfather. So it was a strange mixture of things whereby a country that's just sort of declared its national coming together with federation very soon afterward decided to go on the other side of the world and fight for queen and country of a country that was so separate from their own, but a country nonetheless where generally, at Federation, 23% of the population was born overseas, mainly in Ireland or England and Scotland and so forth. So there was still strong ties to the motherland, and a strong sense of that tradition. So much so that some of the key elements in Federation was the expulsion of the Chinese, which happened in very quick time. The Chinese had come out here from various parts of Asia to work in the gold fields and stayed to establish vegetable farms and various other industries around the place. And the Japanese people had been a key element in the pearling and bêche de mer industries in the tropical seas across northern Australia. So one of the major requisites insisted upon by the trade union movement, the burgeoning trade union, was that we get rid of the Chinese. And that's what happened. That was one of the great supposedly achievements of Federation. an assertion of the long-term racist perspective that still holds this country in its grip. Along with the Chinese, soon after, the Kanaks were expelled. Kanaks were South Sea Islanders who were basically captured and enslaved in the South Pacific in islands like Vanuatu and New Caledonia, and ferried to the sugarcane fields of northern Queensland, where they were forced to live on, well, I don't know if they were actually paid, but they were enslaved into the workforce. But they, in their main, were expelled as one of the conditions of asserting not only the rights of Australian trade unionists to work the jobs that are here, but also to assert a white Anglo-Celtic perspective for occupation of the country. But the tragic irony is that Australia's enthusiasm for the First World War, which was real, and given the number of people who enlisted, soon began to sour with the slaughter that the country had to bear up under. In Gallipoli, for instance, which is celebrated so much as a tragic event, which it surely will, at the behest of people like Winston Churchill, Australia suffered 8,000 casualties. There was and in the war overall, the total deaths for Australia was between 59 and 62,000. So that of those enlisted, at least 14% died in the service of the English Crown. What that meant, in a terrible situation of gross and obscene irony, that was that 1.3 to 1.5% of the Australian population died in the First World War, in the service of Churchill and his likes over there. While Australian troops were used as cannon fodder, the demands of Britain were such that they kept requiring more and more people to enlist, and Australia could not sustain those numbers given its small population and a certain threshold where people were willing to enlist. So what happened under the leadership of a Labour member of Parliament, who was then Prime Minister, Billy Hughes, was to try and introduce conscription. And he did that on two occasions by dint of trying to win a referendum. By working with members of the Murdoch family who were starting their press empire in the service of the First World War from London, Hughes ran two referendums to try and win support in the population. But both of them were defeated. And both of them were defeated primarily because people were realising how many people were being slaughtered as part of the First World War. And also there was a major coalition brought together of very disparate forces, not only International Workers of the World Wobblies, but also the Australia's significant Catholic population, which was primarily Irish in its origin, in the context of the 1915 Easter uprising in Dublin. So that all mix of things had a big impact on the sort of political consequences of the war on the home front. And it's one of the great achievements of Australian politics that the people here, despite what may have been the initial enthusiasm for the war, soon enough changed their minds and defeated the government on the question of whether Labor could bring in conscription.
Capels are on the first fret. First fret, yes, I'd say the first fret. And we're playing it in A.
Sharp?
No, playing it in, no, just stay with it. Right. The capels on the first fret and we're playing it in A. Ignore Ashton.
Sorry.
We are singing in A sharp, that's not the point. We're singing in between the notes.
Stupid Cupid, you're a real mean guy. I'd like to clip your wings so you can fly. I'm in love and it's a crying shame. You've even got me thinking that I'm to blame. Hey, hey, set me free. A stupid cupid, stop picking on me. Can't do my homework and I can't see straight. I meet him every day about 8:30. And now I'm acting like a lovesick fool. You've even got me carrying his books to school. But hey, hey, set me free. Stupid Cupid, stop picking on me. You mixed me up a good right from the very start. Hey, go play Robin Hood with somebody else's heart. You've got me jumping like a crazy clown, and I don't feature what you're putting down. Since I kissed his loving lips of wine, the thing that bothers me is that I like it fine. Hey, hey, set me free. A stupid Cupid, stop picking on me. Cupid, stop picking on me.
From the Scottish Independence Podcast, and this is the second of two interviews. On the last podcast, I interviewed Professor Neil Davidson to talk about the left-wing case for leaving the European Union. Now, to give a bit of balance to the thing, this is the left-wing case for staying in the European Union. And this time I spoke with Colin Fox, who I don't think needs an introduction, and particularly not in this podcast. So, hope you enjoy it. Hi Colin, how's it going?
It's going great, Michael. Smashing in the middle of election fever with just over a week to go. Can hardly contain myself.
No, because I would have thought that at this point in the election campaign, Jim Murphy's marvellous socialist rhetoric, and obviously the fact that he's socialist to his core and he shows it every day, I thought I'd have just convinced you to give up the ghost by now.
Sorry, you lost me there when you said Jim Murphy the socialist. I've no idea who you're talking about. Is there such a person in Scotland? I mean, Jim Murphy, the former Labour MP, with a week to go, I think, is more likely. That's a better nomenclature for the guy, I think. But, you know, the election campaign here in Scotland is like 1997. You know, 1997, if you can cast your mind back to then, the overriding mood was, we've had 20 years of the Tories, we've got to get rid of the Tories. Here we are in 2015, and the overriding mood is, we've got to get rid of the red Tories, we've got to get rid of New Labour, and that's about what we're going to do in a week's time.
Yeah, it's quite bizarre. We've gone from Jim Murphy, Blairite unionist, to Jim Murphy, I'm not a unionist or I'm not a Blairite.
Yeah, he's now trying to pretend he's Leon Trotsky in disguise, but I don't think it'll work for you.
Well, no. I can't really say any more to it than that. But before we get down to the business here, because last time I did an interview, we were talking about the left-wing case for leaving the European Union. But before we get into the left-wing case for staying in, which I think you're going to give us, would you agree that it's important not to leave the left-wing case against the EU to people like UKIP?
Yeah. I mean, the case against the European Union from the left is a principle case. It's perfectly legitimate, perfectly rational, and actually it wants to get to the same objectives that I want to get. So it's more a tactical question than a principled one. So I think it's absolutely right. You're doing the public broadcasting a service by, you know, presenting both sides of the picture. I'm always a great believer in putting both sides of the case fairly and allowing people to engage in the intellectual grey matter rather than, you know, setting up canards. You don't do justice to the other side case, hoping that it makes your case look better. That's never I think that's a reasonable or safe way to go forward. So, yeah, absolutely, put the case against leaving the EU to achieve a socialist federation in Europe, and the case for staying in and changing it from within.
Yeah, so we're not doing call K here. So we're going to get down to call the
call K. Call Michael. Hey, Michael, I've got a problem. No, but yeah, absolutely.
Well, I tend to keep out the lunacy aspect of it, unlike call K. But in the broadest sense, on a principled sense first, what's the case mm-hmm. for the EU?
Well, the 500 million people across Europe are now members of the European Union and the various component countries. 500 million working class people. We have an awful lot in common. And it's essentially, the European Union started as a trading bloc, didn't it, way back in the 1950s. And it's grown and grown. It's now, what, 27, 28 countries, whatever it is. And essentially, it's encouraged that sense of we're in together. It's emphasised the things we have in common, emphasise the thing that we have in common the most, which is that we largely sell our labour on a daily basis, doing our best to survive. So the case of the European Union is, I think, it brings people closer together. And perhaps, I know you can overstate this, but it is worth remembering that there's two world wars that were centred and started in Europe in the 20th century, and it's no small thing that we should try and avoid that collectively as much as we can. So I think there's a strong case for pulling all the resources and all the peoples and all the talents of Europe together for everyone's collective advantage. That's the plan. Admittedly, we're not anywhere near that, but that's the ambition. And I think it's right to have ambitions in politics as in life in general.
And there are certain, now I'm doing the positive case now, and there are certain aspects of the EU that do help for working people in the sense that, right, you've got like the social charter, certain things about contracts, you can't work more than a certain amount of hours, certain things about human rights as well. I mean, these things are not to be sniffed at.
They're not to be sniffed at, but as a socialist, I'm bound to say the potential that exists with 500 million people working together and pulling in the same direction has barely been scratched. The surface of that has barely been scratched. What achievements the European Union has in bringing people together have been very much at the minor end of it and have been very much within a template as long as it's agreed by the major corporations who are in control of it. So the fundamental problem that every socialist across Europe would share is that the European Union's a boss's club. The rules are set down for the bosses, by the bosses, to enhance and to help their trade with one another, but they're often at the detriment of workers, whether they're in Ireland or Romania, you know, the length and breadth of the continent. So there's a great deal more progress can be made. But one of the things I have to say that I'm reminded of, I grew up in the west of Scotland in the 1960s and 70s, and I'm old enough to remember tomatoes being grown in Red Clydeside, red tomatoes. Because in the 1960s, there was greenhouses right along the banks of the Clyde from Motherwell up to Kirkfield Bank and Lanark. And, you know, my dad and mum's generation would tell you tomatoes today don't taste anywhere near as nice as the ones you used to get in, you know, the Clyde Valley in the 1960s. But when you think about that concept, there were massive greenhouses growing tomatoes, largely because the price of keeping those greenhouses warm was so low. And they thought they could compete with areas of Europe, let's say, where tomatoes grow outside and they don't need to have greenhouses full of paraffin, you know. So those days are over, but it did seem for me to hint that there was a socialist plan, that under a socialist plan across continental Europe, those countries with natural and plentiful supplies of sunshine and warmth could grow the tomatoes and Scotland could concentrate on the whisky and the shipbuilding and the other things that we did because of the advantages that we had, natural and others, you know. So that always struck me as a bizarre idea, that Scotland should try and compete with southern Spain or Italy, Greece, Portugal or elsewhere, where huge tomatoes could be grown relatively easily and certainly more cheaply.
So the trading bloc idea of it is one part of it, but I think there's definitely kind of two currents to the EU. There's the social sort of side of it, which is basically mm-hmm. what probably both of us would consider as the positive aspect of it. But then there is a yeah. kind of neoliberal block to it as well. And that's become much more so since the beginning of it. Like you mentioned earlier the fact that, you know, it was the idea of keeping the economies together and that would prevent war, which on the whole it has mm-hmm. done, and that's a marvelous thing and never to be forgotten. But mm-hmm. as we've progressed and with Thatcher and Reagan and the politics of most countries has become more and more neoliberal, the European Union has also gone in that direction as well. So as someone who would support the European Union, how would you defend the EU against that? In that, what should we do about it? What can be done about
perfectly,
it?
Perfectly fair question. I think my answer would be, I support the European Union with enormous caveats. And one of the caveats is that it has to be changed beyond all recognition from the current circumstances, because what happens is that the major corporations of Europe tend to use one country's labour force against the labour force of another country within the EU, you know? So it's not that long ago since, remember, Ford would open plants in certain parts of Europe and then demand that the British workforce or the French workforce or the German or Belgian or Spanish workforce adhere to the same rules of factories in, let's say, Eastern Europe. And if they didn't, those factories would be closed and production would be shipped to, in effect, cheap labour sources. So we have a European Union where, sacre bleu, no news to socialists, of course, the bosses across Europe unite together to exploit working people, regardless of their language, their nationality, or anything like that. That's not the Europe that I want to be part of. I think that my generation, possibly yours generation, Michael, we're able to know many people from across Europe on first-name terms. In Edinburgh, for example, there's a huge number of young Spaniards who've come here recently, and they're very welcome. Young Greeks have come here. There's Italians, there's French. You know, it's a much more cosmopolitan city in Edinburgh, and indeed most places in Scotland, than it was 25 years ago. That's a good thing that Labour has been allowed to travel. It breaks down those barriers and those naff TV programmes, you know, Mind Your Language, where all the national stereotypes of the day were put in front of everybody, which was a disgrace, an outrage. Those have largely been broken down, and that's a good thing. But we still have the problem that the employers, they want to divide and conquer. So, yes, I'm in favour of the EU, but not as it's currently constituted, because the wrong people are in charge of it. And let's not forget, 500 million people, and not a single one of us have any real democratic control over it, because the European Union is run by unelected commissioners appointed by governments. People like Leon Britton, Peter Mandelson, none of these were elected, were they? They were all appointed, and of course, that's where the power is, and that's what's all wrong with it. The power's in the wrong place. It's not at all democratic.
This seems to be the thing. It needs to be, if you wanted to reform it from inside. Now, the mm-hmm. Parliament is there, and a lot of the actual best stuff that comes from the European Union comes from the Parliament.
That's because that's the democratic driver, the democratic driver for change. And all the best changes have come through democracy. All its worst aspects come from the lack of democracy. You know, these commissioners set down rules which state that, you know, you can't have the ferries off the west of Scotland remaining in public ownership. The ferries that leave the docks at the Piraeus port in Greece to all the islands can't remain in public ownership. Who said that? That wasn't the democratic wishes of the peoples of Europe. That was the diktat, in effect, of commissioners, as you say, driven by a neoliberal agenda that best serves Tyson's, Siemens, Peugeot, you know, the big corporate elite in Europe. They're the ones that are driving it. And that's what has to be challenged. I don't think anybody in the left across Europe demure from that. That's a goal that we all share, you know. The question arises is, quite how are you going to challenge their power?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. It's a big question. How do we rebalance it in favour of the social elements? Because it seems that it would need a wide consensus across a number of countries.
It does. You know, that's a $64 million question. And if the left is honest with itself, we're nowhere near as unified in terms of organisation and contact with one another than we ought to be. I mean, I've seen this from my own eyes. I went to Athens in January to witness, invited there by Syriza, you know, the radical coalition of the left in Greece who won the election. And I was coming across people from the Linke in Germany, the French, you know, socialists, the Spanish people in Podemos, Syriza, people from Finland and the left, all these, and thinking to myself, goodness gracious, we've got so little contact with people, and these people, and yet we're charged with such a responsibility to coordinate our work together, press for a common objective, and we need to firm up, be far, far better in our communications with one another and our strategic impulses in the same direction. So that's the answer. I think the answer is to use the 500 million people potentially across Europe who would back up our desires for greater democracy and greater social cohesion and greater social advance than somehow leaving and saying, to hell with it, let them sort out their own trouble. That just seems to me not a tactic that's likely to succeed, you know?
No, I'd agree with that to an extent, because the bones of something that could be very good are there. It just needs to be pushed in another direction.
Absolutely. And I tell you, one of the things that strikes me in Britain, you know, the social charter that you mentioned briefly earlier on, in Britain, a lot of the trade union movement take a pro-Europe position. And yet the root of it is because they want to get the advances for working class people here in Scotland that were fought for by the French working class, the German trade union movement, the Belgian trade union movement, that are a damn sight stronger than the leadership we have here in Britain. But they stood up and fought, that's why they won. Whereas the trade union movement in Britain tend to be that bit lazier and say, well, can we get what they want, but we don't want to have to struggle for it, go and strike for it, agitate, kick Labour up the backside, you know what I mean? So I look across Europe, and you mentioned before, Thatcher, Reagan, others, you know, in Britain, a lot of the progressive social chapters were won by working class people in other parts of Europe pushing the agenda to the left. In truth, Britain has played far too small a part in that. We've contributed far too little to the social progress in Europe and far too much towards the neoliberal finance capital city of London character that is the European Union today. You know, so that's a lesson we've got to take on board here, that working people in Britain and the progressive socialist movement in Britain have a great deal more to do, even to catch up with what's been achieved by our European counterparts in those countries that I've mentioned, you know?
Yeah, and just to finish up, I'll put you on this spot here. I think we're both people that like talking about the ones that you're not supposed to talk about. So, IndyRef2 is the unmentionable here. So, if there is a UK referendum and England votes to leave the European Union and Scotland votes to stay in the European Union, is that a case for IndyRef2?
My categoric answer is yes, it is, because it's a qualitative difference to IndyRef1, isn't it? I mean, I should say, I think the way the general election is going here in Britain, I don't think there'll be a referendum. Because, as you know, Labour and the Liberals and the SNP, who are, I think, more likely to form a government one way or another over the next couple of weeks than the Tories and UKIP and the Liberals. But those three parties' argument is that a referendum in Europe isn't a priority. In fact, it's a distraction. And therefore, they're hardly likely to come forward with one. And I have to say, on top of that, even if there was one, I don't believe there would be a majority for leaving. But to answer your question, in the circumstances, the hypothesis you posed, if there was a referendum, and if England did vote to leave by majority and Scotland voted to stay in the European Union, then I think it's entirely legitimate for us on the yes side to say, hold on, that's a qualitatively different facet of the referendum we had in September 2014. We're entitled to have another one because the majority in Scotland isn't Little Englander. It's not for casting off our ties with Europe. It's for enhancing the social democratic epicentre, do you know what I mean? So that would be the answer I would give you, Michael. Not trying to duck the question, I would say, yes, it does offer us the opportunity for a second referendum. But I have to say, as partisans as we both are, I only want to have the referendum when I'm confident that we're going to win it, because a second lost referendum doesn't bear thinking about. So my attitude is, I want a second referendum, and I want to be clear that we're going to win it, and I think the circumstances have to be different from those that were in existence in September 2014 for it to be legitimate and democratic and supported by the majority of the population.
Well, to finish off where we come in, I think given that position about being partisans and making sure we're going to win it, I think basically all of our efforts should go to keeping Jim Murphy in charge of Labour.
I'm not sure that's in our hands this time next week. If the polls that came out today, believe it or not, suggested that Labour would not win a single seat in Scotland, you know, so you can imagine all the stand-up comedians at this year's Edinburgh Festival saying, you know, there are two giant pandas almost extinct, but there are more giant pandas in Edinburgh or in Scotland or in Britain, in fact, than there are Scottish Labour MPs. So I would have thought that Jim Murphy's days are probably numbered anyway, so I don't know who'll be leading the No campaign in future, but I think they've paid a terrible price, Labour, haven't they? An historically unprecedented price for the role that they played in that referendum. That I think that's more likely, you know, that Jim Murphy's probably toast by this time next week.
And also for people who hope for real change across a number of issues, it goes to show you just how quickly things can really turn around very, very sharpish.
Yeah, it's the unpredictable nature of politics. I mean, this is the gift that keeps on giving. You know, the amount of people I meet who'll say, remember 2 years ago, just over 2 years ago, they would say, Colin, nobody's interested in politics. More people voted in the Big Brother to eject Jimmy or Wilma, whoever her name was, than participated in the 2010 general election. Nobody comes to public meetings. All of a sudden, that argument's not one you heard before. More often, you hear people saying, I'd no idea politics could be so exciting, so much fun, so energising, so full of life, so vital. You know, there's a thirst and an appetite for participation, but a thirst and an appetite for discussion, for learning, for investigating and for research. My goodness me, we've unleashed something extraordinary in Scotland. And again, it's one of the most politicised countries in the world. I don't say that out of a sense of chauvinism. I say that out of a sense of a daily experience where people are talking about, they were talking about the currency this time last year, talking about all sorts of things to do with self-determination. And now they're talking about full fiscal responsibility, the Smith Commission, how we have to move on with the powers of the Scottish Parliament to greater powers. They'll tell you about all the powers that are inherent within full fiscal responsibility that are not sufficient, etc. There's a fantastic appetite for politics, and my view as a socialist is, long may it continue. The more politically aware working class people are, the more I like it, and the more likely, in my view, they are going to not just participate in politics, but they're going to change the world using those ideas as a template.
Thanks very much, Colin.
Brilliant. Always a pleasure, Michael. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Always a pleasure as well. Thank you.
Fantastic. Take care. Bye-bye.
She grew up in Texas on a military base. As a teen in California, she found her place. Standing up with those who had got the shorter straw. Speaking out for justice on both sides of the law. She came to my attention in 1998 when she was elected and she joined the ship of state. But it was in her second term when she really made the news as the sole dissenter, the only one to refuse. Barbara Lee, Barbara Lee, let me take this chance to thank you for your humanity. Barbara Lee, Barbara Lee, Barbara Lee. The month was September 2001. It was time to show the world these colors don't run. Flags of war were waving from New York to L.A. From Shanksville to the Pentagon, they chanted USA. Barbara Lee, Barbara Lee. Surrounded by such darkness, but still able to see. Barbara Lee, Barbara Lee, Barbara Lee. The vote came to the Congress to give the president the right to bomb and to invade any nation in his sights, to kill in any country where his generals wanna go. 500 voted yes, one woman voted no. Barbara Lee, Barbara Lee. A few hundred more like you, what a nation it could be. Barbara Lee, Barbara Lee, Barbara Lee, Barbara Lee, Barbara Lee. There among the madmen of Washington, D.C., Barbara Lee, Barbara Lee, Barbara Lee.
Hello, I'm Deborah Torrens, a member of the SNP branch here in Mulgay. Pose. Pose, pose, pose. No, you haven't tuned into some raving UKIP promotional video. I'm talking about those statistics. I've seen projections that have SNP garner every seat in Scotland, down to 57, 54, 45. Every day it's a different poll and a different number of seats. I mean, really, do you think that 59 is possible? And if it is, should we be getting all excited about that? I'd love nothing more than for Labour to slink away down to their HQ with not a single seat in Scotland, greeting to their masters for a wee bobby. But how would the wee granny who voted Labour her whole life feel about that? With all the media bias that's been shoved in our faces, I wouldn't be surprised if that wee granny forevermore hated SNP, told her grandweans to hate the yellow and black and blamed the SNP for her woes. Without Labour to blame, SNP are going to have to pick up their game, or that wee granny might never vote again. I was reading the National this morning. I don't often read papers that much, but I'm just out the Royal and feeling rather lousy, so my mum has been pampering me and got me the paper. The headline reads, SNP could win every seat in Scotland. The story runs a few pages. All the pictures are of Labour. Gordon, Godzilla, Brown and Jim, eggs over Easy Murphy. It's not until page 4 and you get a wee rather unflattering picture of Nicola. Right next to a big spread of Ruth, nuclear weapons are good, Davidson, sitting on a tank in a rather provocative way. Now this is a paper that by all means supports the SNP in the case for independence. But what does it say when their accompanying images are of other parties? Is that the way we are in Scotland? Do we love a good downfall? Some football fans may say yes, but I'm not going to talk about that, mainly because I've been in an argument with my girlfriend for a year about what exactly is a foul shy. The downfall of Scottish Labour. It's a bit like those reality TV shows that you don't ever want to watch, but a clip will be on Facebook and you know you watch it. You can't take your eyes off it. Bizarre and almost repulsive, but completely compelling to watch. Unlike the Tories, there is every possibility that someone in our family will have voted Labour at some point. Labour was the party of the working class. My mum told me about the only Tory in her village, 1950s Tollcross in East End, and how he was a pariah to all the steelworkers, even the white-collar office workers. Soon enough, the Stuart and Lloyds closed, then the churches, then the cooperative, then the village was consumed by the city, but still, Labour! Then came the tax of taxes, the poll tax. Even when my wee mum was getting shouted at in the post office, oh no, she's paying the bloody poll tax, and my brother was getting lifted for demonstrating in George Square, still, Labour. Then came new Labour. War, recession, different taxes, still everyone was Labour. First time I ever voted, I voted Labour. That's what you'd done. It was ingrained in us all. Vote local who you want, general election time, vote Labour. Guilt tripped into giving them your vote. Oh, you got to vote Labour or the Tories will get in. Thing is, the Tories get in anyway. The whole of Scotland should know about this democratic deficit by now. But even if we have some miracle of proportional representation and we actually got a Labour Party in majority government, would it be all that different? As the late, great Jimmy Reid did say, I never left the Labour Party. The Labour Party left me. I think Scottish Labour have left this planet altogether. And to be honest, I think I'm a wee bit sad about it.
It's been raining cats and dogs since you left. The sun's got lost and the forecast's not too bright. For once they may be right. A cloud above my head, and it's filled with the things that you said. They come raining down like stones, and soak me to the bone. Another song about the rain, my favourite metaphor for pain. Another song about the rain, my favourite metaphor for pain. Another song. Another song about the rain, my favourite metaphor for pain.
This weekend, many of us will be taking part in parades and marches as we rally together to celebrate International Workers' Day. This should serve as a timely reminder of the incredible strength that the workers of the world have when we unite together. And far from being a well-known and oft-used paraphrase, it should mark the recognition and realisation that we have a strong hand, something we often forget as we are continually oppressed and undermined by big business, corporations and governments which only serve their own financial interests. This strength which arrives through organisation and cooperation, an understanding that we can best serve the interests of all in society, when all in society have a fair say and are fairly represented. The organisational capacity of this movement comes in part through political party and trade union participation. In this, Lenin's belief in the benefit of organised political movements leading the revolution still rang true. I would argue today, however, that, particularly in Scotland, the organisation and movement must be directed towards a ballot box revolution. I know some comrades will disagree, however, the mass movement of the Yes campaign has proved it is possible to revolutionise society through the principled aim of democratic election. However, if we look at democratic elections, we must then look at the current political parties and how they will represent the workers. What is clear from these current general elections for Westminster is that none of the Westminster Four, the big four that the media will portray to us, will ever consider the rights and aspirations of the worker as anything other than secondary to retaining power through corporations financing them at the expense of all moral fibres. Voters in Scotland are often led to believe that the SNP are here to protect the interests of the working class. It's a huge folly to believe that. Being to the left of the Labour Party is like Nigel Farage saying he is less racist than Hitler. It still leaves some scope. Socially, the SNP have made some progress, most notably from policies they adopted from the SSP. Free school meals, free prescriptions. At its core, however, the Scottish National Party is still a neoliberal, pro-big business party which relies on financial support from the likes of Brian Suter, of whom it could hardly be said has socialist principles. So it's down to the Scottish Socialist Party to be that political party, that voice, that organisational body. It is our duty to be the voice of the workers to unite, organise, agitate and educate, and become an electorally viable alternative to the neoliberal political parties, neck-deep invested interests. This is a goal which we as a party must continue to strive for, as we continue to grow following the referendum. This has reflections for next Thursday. As you cast your vote, for the four districts which have SSP candidates, I would encourage all those who march this weekend and those who are with them in solidarity to place their mark for one of these four excellent SSP candidates who would represent the people of their districts with distinction and do so on a workers' wage. Our growth as a party, as a movement, will always be an epic struggle. But there's no easy road in doing the right thing, in not succumbing to corporate greed. But the fight continues on, and our growth is dependent on the workers, as they are dependent to the need for us to grow to become the true representation of the people of Scotland. As a party, it is vital that we remain at the forefront of changes, which can better the lives of the many. In Scotland, we have a unique and unmissable opportunity to achieve this through vast renewable energy potential we have. Recently, I was tasked with writing a coherent strategy and policy for our energy consumption. This gives us the opportunity to create a lasting energy supply which reinvigorates the manufacturing industries, creates thousands of well-paid jobs, all of which are enshrined to be a minimum of £10 an hour. These new industries will allow us to demand that workers and consumers have a say in all areas of consultation, planning and administration. Cheaper energy to end fuel poverty. An opportunity to radically transform not only the energy sector, but the lives of every citizen of this nation. We have work to do as a party. Our job, as with any other, is to ask you to place our trust in us to lead you, to ensure that we will always represent the needs, wants and aspirations of the many than the few. I and many other comrades within the Scottish Socialist Party are committed to making this a reality. But that is only half the battle. It's up to the people to choose the alternative, to choose a better way, to unite together, not just for one day a year, but for all the days, to say we want and we deserve better. It's time to unite.
You've got to join your union.
Union, be a proud proletarian.
Proletarian,
come on, join.